Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Hit the like button if you like the video, subscribe to my channel if you want to see more from me, and you can always join my Patreon. We have a big goal there. I will talk about that at the end of the video. This story has it all: sex, scandal, cheating, and murder. It also has a very interesting and recent update that we will talk about at the end of the story. Like the famous O.J. Simpson trial, this trial also involves a very important glove. A glove that wasn't found, and then it was, and then it wasn't tested, but kind of it was. No one really knows what's going on in this case. It's another case of inept police work, leading many to believe that the wrong person has been in prison for decades. So it's 1987, and a new film called Fatal Attraction is released. It stars Michael Douglas and Glenn Close, and although I never saw it until a decade after it came out, it still lives in my memory as one of the first times I remember actually hating a character in a film. The film is about a married man who has an affair with a woman that refuses to let it end, and when he tries to break it off, the things that she does, terrifying. Just 2 years after the release of the film, something happened that took that story out of the film world and brought it into real life. Only the end result in real life was much worse than in the film. It was murder. But did the wrong person get convicted for that murder? This is the story of the murder of Betty Jean Solomon, the Fatal Attraction murder. I'm your host, Stacey Lee. Let's get into it. January 15th, 1989. A call comes in to the Greenberg, New York 911 dispatch center at 7:15 p.m. Operator Linda Viana answers the call. She immediately hears a woman scream, "He's killing me." At least, that's what she first reports that she hears. The call abruptly cuts off, which triggers an automatic response by the police. But the 1989 system was not what it is now, and the police couldn't find anything in the reverse directory with an address that matched the phone number attached to the 911 call. Some reports state that the police actually went to the wrong address at first and discovered the people in the home safe and well. But then, at 11:42 p.m., a second call comes in from the same address. This time, the caller gives the police the address and they arrive here. This is the Greenberg, New York condominium of Paul Solomon, his wife, Betty Jean Solomon, and their 15-year-old daughter, Kristen. The police arrive at the condo and make entry into the home. There, they find Paul Solomon waiting for them, who reports that he has just returned home from a night at the bowling alley. His wife, Betty Jean Solomon, is dead on the floor in the living room, lying on a bloody carpet. The phone used in the earlier 911 call is lying on the floor near the dining table. There was blood on the carpet in the dining room and in the living room, obviously under Betty Jean's body. She had been shot not once or twice, but 9 times. She had also been brutally pistol whipped. It also appeared that her body had been rolled over, and later Paul Solomon would tell police he did that when he found his wife after coming home. There was something else that caught police attention. The telephone used to make the 911 call had no blood on it. None whatsoever, not a drop. And this was very strange, seeing as how the murdered woman had apparently made a phone call as she was being shot. The phone was a rotary dial, not a push button, so that meant that Betty Jean would have had to engage in the slow process of putting her fingers into the rotary phone and dialing it, all while either having a gun pointed at her or just after being shot. So that begs the question, why would the killer allow her to stand there and use the phone either while they were pointing the gun at her or while she was being shot, especially a rotary phone that we know takes a few seconds to use? It wasn't as if she had a cell phone and had already dialed 911 and then just hit the button. She called 911 in front of her killer. Or like I said, did she? We're going to get into that in a moment. Paul Solomon appears distraught. He was crying and upset and told the police, "I got home, the first thing I heard was the TV on very loud. I walked into the living room, the lights were out, and I noticed that Betty Jean was on the floor. I assumed she was asleep. I touched her and she was cold. I went and turned the lights on, I turned her over, and there was blood. I thought she had fallen and hit her head." If Jason walked in and found me in the dark, laying on my face against a wall in my clothes, I don't think he would think I was asleep. I found that part of his statement to be odd. But anyway, the police noticed that there is no sign of a struggle in the room, but someone had pulled the telephone receiver off the wall. But who? And again, why wasn't there any blood on the receiver if Betty Jean had used it? Nothing was stolen. Nothing was out of place. Betty Jean had been shot where she stood, which I want to point out was not at the front door. Whoever had done this was in the house with her. They had been let into the house, or they had lived in the house. Police bring in the forensics team to collect evidence, and they take photographs, the ones I'm showing you now, of the crime scene. But something happens in those few moments that changes the course of this case and the course of the investigation, and it's pretty shocking. As you can clearly see in this photo, there is a black glove lying on the floor, partially under the sofa and partially uncovered out in the open. A crime scene investigator picks up the glove and sprays it with a blood reagent spray and sees that there is, to his naked eye, no blood on the glove. So this glove, found lying near a murdered woman at a crime scene, was not collected as part of the evidence. You heard that right. This single action would become the source of major debate later on. Betty Jean Solomon's body is removed from the house and her family is contacted. Earlier in the day, which was a Sunday, Paul and Betty Jean had been home watching television while Kristen was on a weekend ski trip with her friends. Paul later claimed that he and his wife had been intimate that morning, that they'd spent the morning together, and that their marriage was strong. Paul Solomon was lying. Earlier on that day, at 1:37 in the afternoon, the Solomon phone had rung. Now, this happened while Paul and his wife were supposedly watching TV together. On the other end of the phone was 25-year-old Carolyn Warmus, Paul's lover. Well, let me rephrase that. One of Paul's lovers. The call lasted for 55 minutes. Paul Solomon was a school teacher and he was also a known womanizer. Paul is Mediterranean. He has a thick head of dark hair, dark skin, and a thick mustache. I think women found him attractive. There's an episode of Bob's Burgers. If you don't watch that show, you should, where Bob, who has similar coloring, is called swarthy. I guess you could describe Paul Solomon as swarthy. He and Betty Jean had been married for at least 17 years. There are varying dates for the marriage online, and 40-year-old Betty Jean worked as an accountant. People who knew the couple state that they would be very surprised to learn that Betty Jean was unaware of Paul's philandering because everyone knew about it. Perhaps it was one of those situations where the partner chooses to look the other way to keep the family together. I don't know. But it was not tough to catch Paul Solomon's eye. Many women had. And then one day, a new teacher arrived at the school fresh out of college, and Paul Solomon decided he had to have her. January 8th, 1964. Carolyn Alan Warmus is born in Troy, Michigan, to Thomas A. Warmus, a multimillionaire who made his fortune in the insurance business. Thomas Warmus is actually the founder of the American Way Life Insurance Company. So Carolyn lived a very privileged life, and that's putting it mildly. There were very expensive ski vacations, luxury trips to the tropics, and lots of expensive clothes. Carolyn was blonde and slight and described as the girl next door, the girl you would want to bring home to your mother. But Carolyn was not what she seemed on the surface. In 1970, when Carolyn was 6 years old, her mother Elizabeth filed for divorce from Thomas, and she got custody of Carolyn and her two younger siblings. This didn't affect the way Carolyn was raised financially. She had everything any kid could ever want and more. She got good grades. She was athletic. She was on the basketball team. Carolyn graduated from Seaholm High School and then enrolled at University of Michigan. She graduated with a degree in psychology, and then she moved to Manhattan, where she was accepted into the Teachers College at Columbia University. Now, that's impressive. My niece is at Columbia right now. It is very, very difficult to get into Columbia if you don't have connections, which my niece does not. Carolyn was from a very wealthy family, so that could have had something to do with it. But still, they don't take people who aren't focused and diligent with their studies. Carolyn was smart. In September of 1987, after graduating, Carolyn got a job at the Greenville Elementary School in Scarsdale, New York. She was obviously a very compassionate person on some level, because here she is, she's got all this money, all the money in the world, and she becomes a school teacher. I think that says something about her personality. I did see an interview where she talks about the fact that she loves kids. So maybe her love of kids drove her into teaching, but Carolyn also loved something else. Partying. Now, this is the late 1980s in New York City. This is Party Central, and Carolyn was enjoying every minute of it. She admits that. She was a party girl. She had lots of boyfriends and lots of one-night stands, and she freely indulged in the excesses of the 1980s. When she and Paul Solomon met, it was kind of gasoline and fire. There was an instant attraction between them, and Paul later said that Carolyn was, quote, very difficult to resist. Paul Solomon is a fifth grade teacher, and his wife is working in accounting. They're living in a very modest condo in the suburbs. Carolyn is this not just rich, but very rich young woman of 25, worldly, well-traveled, and with literally the best education available in the world. She was, I'm sure, pretty impressive. Paul and Carolyn almost immediately began sleeping together. The affair went on for weeks, and then months, and then more than a year. During that time, Paul began to see a side of Carolyn that he didn't like. She was controlling and she was possessive, and he started to ask around about her. He didn't like what he heard. Carolyn Warmus, I think you could say, has daddy issues. She has a very long history of chasing unattainable men. In 1983, when she was a sophomore at the University of Michigan, she met and began dating a man named Paul Lavin, who was a teaching assistant. Paul ended up breaking up with Carolyn, and then he got engaged to another woman, and Carolyn went ballistic upon hearing about the engagement. She began calling Paul incessantly, leaving messages over and over on his answering machine. When Paul didn't call her back, she began showing up at his place of employment and harassing him there. One time she broke into Paul's apartment while he was there with his new fiance, and she had to be physically removed by the police. Then Paul's fiance found a note written to her by Carolyn, and it said, quote, I really hope you enjoyed this past week of not being bothered by me, because now that I'm back from vacation, you can start worrying all over again. Yikes! That is every shade of red flag behavior. That's very, very scary behavior. And I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but the couple ended up getting a permanent injunction to keep Carolyn away from them. They actually got married in 1984, and even after that, Carolyn continued to try and contact them. She even converted to Judaism, which is Paul's religion. Friends report that Carolyn even became suicidal during this time as well. She was distraught and out of her mind about Paul's marriage. Then, after she graduated college and moved to New York, just before she got the school teaching job, she met and very briefly dated a bartender from New Jersey. She was worried this man might be seeing other women. So Carolyn hired this man, Jim Russo, a private investigator that works for this man, Vincent Parco, who will come up later on in the story. What did Carolyn want Jim Russo to do? Obtain compromising photos of she and the bartender together in order to send those photos to the bartender's wife. Yes, she hired the investigator to follow and spy on her while she was with the married bartender. I couldn't find any details on what happened, but they weren't able to get the photos that they wanted. So Carolyn asked the PI to fabricate and doctor some images to send to the bartender's wife. So I know what you're thinking. This woman is obviously psychotic and she most definitely did whatever she's accused of. But hang on. Luckily for this bartender, Carolyn met Paul Solomon and forgot about him. Lucky for the bartender, very unlucky for poor Betty Jean Solomon. Police immediately zoned in on Paul as a suspect. Paul said he had an alibi. He had been bowling with friends. The police weren't convinced by what his friends told them, though. Yes, Paul had been at the bowling alley. The stories on how long varied. So they put a tail on Paul and began watching his every move. When they did that, they very quickly realized that Paul Solomon was rarely alone. They weren't the only ones tailing him or watching him. There was someone else. Carolyn Warmus. As they dug deeper into Paul's alibi, something became clear. He did, in fact, meet his friends to go to the bowling alley, but he didn't stay that long. Remember that phone call that came in at 1:37 earlier in the day while Paul was at home watching TV with Betty Jean? That call was from his lover, Carolyn, and she informed Paul that she wasn't very happy about the fact that Paul hadn't taken her out for her birthday the previous week. She wanted Paul to make it up to her. So Paul agreed to meet her that night, but not before meeting up with his friends. He had to make sure he had a reason to get out of the house, a reason that Betty Jean could look into if she needed to. The question is, did Paul meet with his friends just because he needed that alibi for meeting his mistress? Or did Paul meet with his friends because he needed an alibi for murder? Paul left the bowling alley and drove here to this Yonkers Holiday Inn motel, which had a restaurant in it called Treetops, and that's where he met Carolyn. The two had dinner inside Treetops and sat and drank for about 2 hours. The waiter later reported that they were in deep conversation. Then Paul returned home, where he claims to have found his wife dead in the living room. Now, pretty quickly, Paul confessed to the affair with Carolyn. He left it out in his first interview, but he pretty quickly fessed up. He actually used Carolyn for part of his alibi. Now, there's another piece of information that's interesting. Paul's car, a 1983 Toyota Celica, was at his house on the battery charger all day. This guy had actually taken his wife's car, a 1988 Dodge, to go meet his girlfriend. And then after he met his girlfriend and had dinner with her, they had sex in the car in the parking lot, in the wife's car. Carolyn might have been controlling and possessive, but let's not write off the crazy manipulator and liar that is Paul Solomon. You know what I mean? Oh, and by the way, Paul later reported that the deep conversation that the waiter saw was Carolyn saying she hated dating in New York as he was telling her that she deserved to be happy and he would love to dance at her wedding one day. Carolyn's story, as you might imagine, is different. She claims the conversation was her demanding that Paul hold to his word to do what he'd been telling Carolyn for over a year he was going to do, leave his wife for her. So it's he said, she said, we will never know. But we do know that there are very different versions of where the relationship was at that time, depending on whether you were to ask Paul or Carolyn. Here's where the case first begins to take a turn, with investigators going away from Paul Solomon and towards Carolyn Warmus. Paul Solomon's buddies at the bowling alley told police that Paul left the bowling alley at around 7:15. Someone actually mentioned the time when he got up and left, and that's why they remembered. Well, 7:15 is the exact time the first call came into 911, the call where the operator thought she heard, "He's killing me," and then the hang-up occurred. How could Paul Solomon be the killer if the killing happened at the exact time he was seen leaving the bowling alley? We've got another issue. The 911 dispatch officer later told police that she could not clearly recall whether she heard "he's killing me" or "she's killing me." Now, I was under the impression that 911 calls have always been recorded. I thought since the inception of 911, the calls were taped. I did find a copyrighted snippet of the second call when Paul called 911 later on at night, so I know they had the capability of recording the calls. I don't know if the first call that came in at 7:15, the either "she" or "he's killing me" call, was just never released to the public or what. I couldn't find it anywhere. Obviously, I wanted to play it so you guys could hear it to see what you thought you heard. On the later call that comes in when Paul finds his wife, he says, "It's my wife. I think she's dead. I need help. My name is Paul Solomon. She's not moving. She's covered with blood. Please hurry." They thought they had a strong clue, Betty Jean screaming, "he's killing me," and now they were being told it could have been "she's killing me." Carolyn and Paul met at the Treetop restaurant at 7:45. That was confirmed. So there's a 30-minute window between the time of the first 911 call and the meeting at the restaurant. The police decided it was time to talk to Carolyn Warmus. January 19th, 1989. Carolyn Warmus reports to the police station as she was asked to do. The police simply called her on the phone and asked her to come in, and she did. Officer Constantino asked, "How are you?" And Carolyn simply answered, "Fine." And then she asked for a lawyer, which is exactly what you should do in her situation. You guys know I'm a broken record over this. If you ever find yourself in a serious situation, do not talk to the cops without a lawyer. You are just asking for trouble. So at that point, the police had no choice. They had to let Carolyn go. By spring of 1989, the investigation had hit a brick wall. But then the cops turned their attention to Carolyn Warmus's phone records and found something very interesting. Remember that private investigator that I mentioned earlier, the one that owned the agency Jim Russo worked for when Carolyn hired him to spy on the New York bartender? Well, the owner of that agency is Vincent Parco. And police wondered why on earth Carolyn, as they looked at her phone records, was calling him like all the time. Carolyn had called Vincent Parco multiple times on the day before the murder and on the day after the murder. So the police go to Vincent Parco, who tells them that Carolyn is just a former client of his. She'd hired him to check on a previous boyfriend. Parco tells the cops he'd never done any additional work for Carolyn and that the two were just friendly and stayed in touch. Yeah, bullshit. When I hire someone like a realtor or an accountant, you know, you talk to them as the transaction is taking place, and that's it. You maybe send them a Christmas card, maybe a Merry Christmas text. You don't call them multiple times a day, and especially the day before and after a murder that you're tied to. Well, the cops didn't buy it either. And as the investigation dragged on, Vincent Parco's statements began to change. The story changed every time the cops talked to Vincent Parco. By the way, Parco ended up going to prison in 2019 for a really disgusting crime. Something about harassing a victim of child SA to keep that person from testifying against their abuser. So I'm going to bite my tongue on what I think about Vincent Parco. The police went to Parco several times, and each time he changed his story, and about the third or fourth time, he could see that he was not getting off so easy, and he decides to give them a little more information than he originally did. Parco tells the cops that shortly before Betty Jean was murdered, Carolyn Warmus asked him where she could get a gun. He just conveniently left that part out for months and months, you know, really stand-up guy. Carolyn even told Parco that she wanted a silencer for the gun. Vincent Parco claims that Carolyn relentlessly pursued him about the gun, and finally he relented. So in early January 1989, just 10 days or so before the murder, Vincent Parco sold Carolyn Warmus a .25 caliber automatic pistol fitted with a silencer for the cost of $2,500. It wasn't relevant, you guys. It wasn't relevant to tell the police that. Somebody had given the gun to Parco as a gift, that's what he claimed, and Parco had had it fitted for the silencer. Nothing strange going on here. Just selling a $100 gun for almost $3,000 in 1989, which is somebody do the math, over 10 grand now, and having that illegally sold gun fitted with a silencer. Nothing to see here, folks. Nothing to see. Oh, and the gun was a Beretta. What type of gun was used to kill Betty Jean Solomon? A .25 caliber pistol that was most likely a Beretta. The gun was never recovered, but the man who fitted the gun with a silencer had test fired the gun before returning it to Vincent Parco. He still had the shell casing. So the cop matched the striations on the shell casing from that test firing to the striations on the casing found under Betty Jean's body. They had a perfect match. The police continued to go through Carolyn's phone records, and they find out she had been making calls to a place called Ray's Sport Shop in North Plainfield, New Jersey. One of those calls was made at 3:02 in the afternoon on the day of Betty Jean's murder. The store owner pulled the sales records for that day. They had sold 4 boxes of .25 caliber ammunition on January 15th, and one of them had been sold to a woman. Everyone in the store remembered the woman because she told them that she had driven all the way to New Jersey from Long Island, and the employees were like, why would someone drive that far to purchase a box of bullets? The woman had left her name, as is required in New York. What a concept, keeping track of people who buy things that kill others, right? Buy all the ammunition you want. I've got ammo boxes and duffel bags full of ammo, but we need to keep track of who's buying it and when. That's a different conversation, but it helps a lot in situations like this. Anyway, the woman had given her name as Lisa Katai and even had a New York driver's license with that name on it. So the police tracked down Lisa Katai. I bet you are going to die of shock when you hear this. But Lisa had never been to Ray's Sport Shop and told police that her license had been either lost or stolen months earlier. She had even reported it as lost and received a duplicate license from the DMV. And it just so happens that Lisa lost her license while she was working at a kids' summer education camp with Carolyn Warmus. And that was all the police needed to make an arrest. February 1990. Carolyn Warmus is arrested and then indicted on charges of second-degree murder and criminal possession of a weapon. Her first trial began on January 14th, 1991. And when I tell you guys it was a sensation, I don't remember this trial. It was on the East Coast. It didn't really make its way to Utah. I would have been about 20 when this happened. But apparently, back East especially, this case was like bigger than the OJ trial. This infamous photo was snapped of Carolyn dressed to the nines, all in Chanel head to toe, stepping out of a private limo service car, arriving at the courtroom. It did not make a good first impression on the public. Her suit was valued at something like $8,000 back in 1991. I mean, not a good move. The media, however, loved it, eating it up. Headlines were being splashed on the paper day after day, calling Carolyn a sex tigress, a black widow, and a woman obsessed. And then, as the press learned about Carolyn's past relationships, about the permanent injunction obtained by Paul and his new fiance, then they learned about the bartender, they realized they'd heard a story very similar not that long ago about a crazed woman who wouldn't leave her ex-lovers alone. The storyline of the massively popular film Fatal Attraction. And once they printed that title, it was set in stone. People were obsessed with the Fatal Attraction murder. It was all people in that area were talking about. Like I said in the beginning, it has everything that makes a great true crime story. Sex and lies, cheating, a shady private investigator, sex in a seedy motel parking lot, a rich young woman with a married man, and murder. It literally has it all. The Toronto Star printed, quote, Carolyn Warmus, at times so demure, so alluring, was every bit as obsessive and lethal as her fictional counterpart. The real life case is even harder to believe than the fiction. Not long after the media frenzy began, rumors started flying that Paul Solomon had sold the rights to his story to HBO for a massive amount of money. Well, HBO never ended up making a film about this story, but there were films made about the case. I think two TV movies. Carolyn was hustled into court each day, many days covering her head as the press clamored to get a photo of her. When she went in and out of the courtroom, she always had big sunglasses and a hat. I think she thought she was getting off from this charge and she wanted to protect her identity. And then on the day this very famous photo was snapped in court, Carolyn knew her face had been captured and she put her head down in her hands and wept loudly in the courtroom because she knew, you know, no hat, no coat over her face, no sunglasses. This was pre-internet. You actually had to take a photo of someone to have a photo of someone. Oh, the good old days. At the beginning of the trial, Carolyn appeared in very tight, very short miniskirts, very expensive designer miniskirts at that. She was looking like a model, not a murder defendant, and she was very much the femme fatale the press was reporting her to be. She was also seen as obsessed, so obsessed that she was willing to throw away her life of privilege and luxury to be with this older, married school teacher. And there was definitely something off about that to people. I mean, it's strange. The trial was sensational and the attorneys were both aggressive and angry and theatrical, but in the end, neither could convince a jury. They hung on a vote of 8 for conviction, 4 for not guilty, and then the prosecution immediately announced they would retry the case. Vincent Parco even took the stand. He told the jury about the gun. The jury also found out about the affair, about Carolyn's past behavior. They knew about Paul's philandering. They just, for some reason, couldn't make a decision. But here is what they did not know. They didn't know about the glove. Remember that glove under the sofa at the crime scene. The second trial began in January of 1992. Along the way, it comes out that in the first trial, Carolyn had forged her own phone records. She had doctored them or had them doctored to make it appear as though she had never called Ray's Sports Shop in New Jersey. The police got the original phone records from the phone company and verified the ones Carolyn's attorney had turned in had been altered. Carolyn is capable of a lot. But anyway, Carolyn gets charged and indicted for forgery and tampering with physical evidence. That charge eventually goes away, but she's very manipulative. Interest in the second trial was just as high as it was for the first. There had been 2 movies made about this case, so people were even more interested at that point. But in this trial, Carolyn's defense team brings up the glove. Now, we're starting to run short on time here, but it turns out that the glove had actually been given back to Paul Solomon. And then he had boxed it up with some other pieces of evidence from the crime scene and just stuck them in a box and put them in a closet. It is truly unreal. It really is. Evidence from a crime scene just being given back to the dead woman's husband. Very much like the case I covered a couple of weeks ago, Nona Dirksmeyer, where she was murdered and before the trial even started, the cops gave her dad, her stepdad, the cell phone back. Like, it makes your brain bleed. So Carolyn's attorneys for the second trial get Paul to turn over the glove that has never been tested for blood or DNA. And that sets in motion a very vitriolic exchange between the attorneys. But in the end, it really doesn't change anything. For several different reasons, the defense was not successful in forcing testing of the glove or forcing that the glove be entered into evidence. And it has to do with the fact that it had been out of the chain of custody for so long. The prosecution argued that they couldn't rely on anything from the glove because it hadn't been treated properly as evidence. But the glove comes back in a very surprising update for this case. The jury deliberated for 6 days and then announced it had reached a verdict. The forewoman stood and read it out loud, guilty. Carolyn Warmus was guilty of the murder of Betty Jean Solomon, and she was sent off to the prison at the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women. On the same day, Carolyn's attorney announced a reward of $250,000 for any information leading to the real killer, and Carolyn's family denounced the trial as, quote, bogus. Paul Solomon was removed from the classroom, but kept his job in a non-teaching capacity. Neither he nor his daughter, Kristen, have ever spoken publicly about this case. For 27 years, Carolyn Warmus sat in prison, all the while proclaiming vehemently that she was innocent. I could not find an interview that wasn't copyrighted, but I will tell you, this woman is very convincing. She is well-spoken. She is intelligent. She has a very polite and personable way of talking. And I can completely see how there are people who are absolutely convinced she took the fall for Paul. One man is so convinced that he's using part of his multi-million-dollar settlement for his own wrongful conviction to help clear Carolyn's name. Even the cop that worked this case has stated, yes, there were huge mistakes made, and he understands why people might not think Carolyn did this. There is not, you guys remember, a single shred of physical evidence against Carolyn. It's only circumstantial. In my opinion, a lot of that circumstantial evidence could be used against Paul as well, right? The timelines are there. Carolyn and Paul could have been in on it together. She could have been at the house, made the phone call while he was at the bowling alley. I don't know. The fact that there was no struggle at the house leads me to think about Paul. But also, you have to remember, Betty Jean probably knew who Carolyn was from school. She could have very easily let Carolyn into the house because she may have known her. Now, if you're asking me straight up, I think Carolyn did this. Her past behavior alone is a huge indicator of this type of dangerous individual. But there is also a lot of circumstantial evidence for me, too much to think that Carolyn is innocent. But here's where it's at. Carolyn is out of prison. She was released in 2019 on a compassionate release. It appears that she has had some type of a stroke and she is not in good health. She is 59 years old and she is still fighting to clear her name. She is working with an innocence project and she says she is going to convince the world that she did not kill Betty Jean Solomon. How is she going to do that? By finally getting her hands on that glove. Her attorneys have successfully obtained the glove and it has been sent off for DNA testing. The results are not back. You know I will update you as soon as we hear anything. A reporter asked Carolyn what she expects to have happen when the DNA testing comes back. And Carolyn, it's kind of strange. She looks straight into the reporter's eyes and says, "If the glove comes back with my DNA on it, then so be it. What do I have to lose? I've already lost 30 years of my life." I thought that was a very telling response. What do you think? Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Hit the like button if you like the video, subscribe to the channel if you want to see more, and you can always join my Patreon. We have a big goal there, and it's this. We would like to raise money to donate to police departments that have cold case DNA in storage that's never been tested because there's no money to test it. There are thousands of sexual assault kits sitting in refrigeration that have never been tested. They cost between $5 and $750 each. Our community would like to start raising money, pick a case, get that kit tested, and hopefully solve the crime. The other thing we do is get that perpetrator's DNA in the system in case they're associated with other crimes. After the first of the year, this channel is rebranding. It will become Dark Hearts with Stacey Lee. And one of the first things we're going to do is raise the money and get that first kit tested. Hopefully it will lead to many more. I sure appreciate you guys. I know there are so many options for things to watch. So the fact that you spend a little bit of your day with me, it just means the world to me. Stay sane during this holiday time. Take a breath. Relax, stay calm, take care of yourself, take care of each other, be kind to each other, and I will see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
While the world whizzes by, enjoy a moment of me time with Tim Horton's $6 breakfast bundle. Savor a small hot or iced coffee, then add your choice of a mouth-watering hot breakfast sandwich and a crispy golden hash brown and your pick of a classic donut.
Yeah.
All for $6, all just for you. Make your mornings all about me time with our $6 breakfast bundle. Available at your neighborhood Tim Hortons. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.